and a faculty member of the OSHA Training Institute Education Center. Ms. Holroyd is also the director for the Center for Young Worker Safety and Health at Georgia Tech Research Institute. She earned her joint Master of Science in Public Health and Epidemiology and Environmental and Occupational Health from Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University. Thanks for your help, Sonia.
Good morning, everyone. I'm here to talk about risk communication strategies in the recycling industry. I have no relationships to disclose. Just a brief background, I'm a consultant for the Georgia Tech OSHA consultation program. A background is on-site consultation is a free confidential service that is offered through funding through OSHA. At Georgia Tech, we typically provide assistance to 365 businesses a year, reaching about 50,000 workers when we tally up all of the employees that work for those individual companies. And as a result of that, we typically choose different emphasis areas, and one of those is the scrap metal industry. And so for the past couple of years, we've been doing a lot of inspections and site visits with the recycling industry, and these are big, huge scrap yards where they're doing lots of different things, doing different streams of recycling at those facilities, and it is to support a regional emphasis in recycling. And we also want to provide employers and employees with a coordinated effort to sort of summarize succinctly what their exposures are with lead, arsenic, cadmium, and hexavalent chromium. So the big players in those heavy metals we're very concerned about. And we want to really recommend best practices, and I'll give you an example during my presentation that really goes over the fact that these exposures vary greatly on a day-to-day basis, but the overwhelming exposure to the employees can be very serious. And as stated in the previous presentation, the recycling industry is a huge industry. And you can read all of these statistics, but I'll tell you what we found going out to these scrap yards is that it is a highly competitive environment. It is a highly, they're usually found in not very safe or high crime areas. And the metal recycling industry is associated with a lot of theft. So you have people stealing copper from buildings, air conditioning units, and then trying to off it at these scrap yards. So there is a different environment when you're entering into. You're entering into an environment with bulletproof windows. You're entering an environment where there are guns on the premise. So it's a different kind of work environment that you're entering into. So that sort of caveat is what you keep in mind when you're looking at the exposures. It's a broad range. The hazards are air contaminants. Obviously, this is a picture of a torch cutter that we took during one of our site visits. You can visibly see his air contaminant exposures. And there's tons of noise. It's a huge facility. There's huge facilities with lots of equipment. We're very concerned about hygiene, skin exposures, ingestion of chemicals. If you're working in a scrapyard, it's 100 degrees out, you're fully suited up in your gear, but it's also 110 degrees out and you're sweating. You're going to be consuming fluids at the same time while you're working. You're not going to take a break, go into a facility, wash up, and then consume liquids. So we've got a huge concern about ingestion. Heat is one of our primary. We're in Georgia. So South Georgia at the recycling facilities during the summer, it can be pretty oppressive environment to work in. And then other hazards, slips, trips, and falls, material handling, fires and explosions, sharp objects, and radiation is another concern. So materials that have radiation in them are being brought into the facility and then with the expectation that they be recycled. I'm going to emphasize and focus the rest of my presentation on the shearing process or the torch cutting process where you're taking the metal and you're bringing it down to size. So typically, you have to bring the metal down to about 6 feet or smaller to be able to put it into the mechanical shears. So you have torch cutters that spend their entire day from sunup till sundown using torches to physically, using gases, cut the metal in half. It's an amazing process to see metal literally ripped in half. We, over the course of several years, have visited 13 sites. Some of them more than once. So some of them we've been to a couple of times, and we did 11 sites where they do torch cutting. So overall, we've sampled for 31 torch cutters, and we did full shift monitoring, and we analyzed the results for a variety of elements, but I'm going to focus on the main four heavy metals. For the 30 samples that had lead results, the average was at the action level for lead. So it was 0.30 micrograms per cubic meter or 0.03 milligrams per cubic meter. We saw lots of exposures as far as cadmium, arsenic, and hexavalent chromium. We only had 14 samples for hexavalent chromium because typically you know if the exposures are going to be to hex chrome because it is a specific type of metal, usually stainless steel, you usually know that it's present, whereas the arsenic, the lead, and the cadmium, you don't know if they're present in the metals or if they're present on the surfaces. So if you go out to a facility that just got in a shipment from a bridge that was being taken apart, there may be remnants of paint, there may be remnants of a variety of things on the material itself that they're cutting, and there's not always the emphasis done at removing those materials before the torch cutting takes place. And to sum up our results, of about 33% or a third of our samples were over the action level for lead. About 30% were over the action level for arsenic, and we saw quite as many overexposures for cadmium and hexavalent chromium. So if we as industrial hygienists want to present our results to employers, we're kind of in this catch-22 because with the consultation program, we're only typically invited out to a company once. We get one shot to give them as much assistance as we possibly can, and that we have to deal with things of the statistical anomaly that we're going to go out there on a day when their exposures may or may not be typical for on a day-to-day basis. And if we were to use typical statistics, and I put this graph in here just to give you an example, if I'm going to present my results to an employer, they may not understand when I'm trying to explain to them the statistical probability that they're going to be over the limit. So this, to me, these tables and graphs don't make inherent sense, and they aren't translated well to the employers we go to. So we have a huge problem where this is an example of a company that we went out to. This guy spends all day in this massive heap of metal breaking everything down. And you can see that weather plays a huge role. So here, thankfully, it had rained. And that's a huge advantage because it keeps the dust down. But if you go 5 or 6 days with hot, oppressive heat, it dries out. And then you have a dust bowl that you're also contending with. And typically, we only have a very small sample size, so 1 to 4 individuals that you would sample. And so this is the results from one company that I went out to. And as you can see, for the lead exposure, we only did 5 torch cutters, and all 5 of those torch cutters are below the action level for lead. So I'm just looking at lead, and I'm looking at the fact that I went out to this company, they're within the limit, so this ties my hands to being able to require respiratory protection, to require medical surveillance, to require quarterly monitoring for lead. I can no longer make these recommendations based off of the standard or the letter of the law. But the caveat to that is I know that the inherent risk, the variable nature of the industry, they are going to be overexposed. So my job and my moral and ethical purpose is to convince them that they need to take part in all of the elements of a lead, cadmium, arsenic, different metal programs. And so, again, just reiterating that if you're under the limit, typically, on a certain amount of time, you can say, I am not complying with the, I don't have to comply with these standards. So we found over the past year that communicating the risk in terms of probability is probably one of the best methods to get their attention. It's running the risk and telling employers, you have this much of a chance of being over the limit. And it's really important when you are talking about this high variability as far as the materials that they bring in on a day-to-day basis change, and the weather conditions are a huge factor. This is all done outside. It's all done and contingent on the temperature, the environment, and the wind. So all of these factors play into what the typical exposures would be. We chose to take part in using what we what is termed as this Bayesian decision analysis, and it categorizes the risk in the American Industrial Hygiene Assessment categories. And the nice thing about this is it allows you to use an informed prior sort of that IH's professional judgment in conjunction with the exposure monitoring results to give you a result that kind of combines the two. So it's the best of both worlds. And we used a program called IH Data Analyst. And so basic IH categories, categories 0 through 3 are all those that are below the permissible exposure limit. This is based off of probabilities. I'm trying to figure out that 95% confidence interval that the exposures are going to be within that category, whereas category 4, I know that I have a 95% chance that we're going to be over the occupational exposure limit. So what you do is I took those same results that I showed you, those five data points that we did the sampling for one company. I made the prior decision that this is a very high hazard exposure, and I put that it was medium certainty. So I'm giving the information into the system that there is going to be some type of exposure. The likelihood is the results specifically for that company. And then the posterior, the bottom graph, shows you the probability for that individual company based on those five data points of being over the limit. So this is just our way of showing them a graph. You have a 60% chance of being over that, within that 95% confidence interval, you're going to be over the limit. And that's our way of assuring or telling them that they are going to need some form of system respiratory protection engineering controls. So other regulatory concerns that we have is definitely the take-home exposure, exposure to employees not performing the torch cutting that are working in the environment. But by far and large, all of these different exposures are really the driving force of our concern is the fact that they are primarily, without a doubt, almost every company use contracts. So they're all temporary workers. And so we go out to companies and we have to pull out legal documents where we're looking at the contracts to see whether or not they have safety and health even mentioned in the contract, and then try to find out whether or not these subsidiary companies are doing the actual monitoring or any of the other items. And what we found overall is that medical surveillance programs should, without a doubt, for all torch cutters be for lead and arsenic, but we recommend expanding that to cadmium and hexchrome as well, that there should be training programs for all four of those metals, specific HAZCOM-focused training. We recommend quarterly industrial hygiene sampling. We recommend the full-out requirement of respiratory protection for all of those employees, and that they have designated work clothes and boots that are left at the facility, that you're not bringing those home. A lot of the employees are bringing these exposures home to their families, which is devastating the impact that lead and other heavy metals can have on small children and family members. And making sure that they're using the showers. That's a huge issue if they even work. So we found that they'd say they're showers, but then we'd go out and actually test them, and they were just sort of there in look and appeal. And a lunchroom with decontamination procedures. And those are my sources. So do I have time for questions?
You do.
Okay. Mary?
Very nice. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you go back and check in,
So the question was, do we go back and check on how the companies are taking to our recommendations? The answer is it depends. And as per the consultation service, we are required to accept the corrections based off of written documentation. And we are not required to go back out and do additional follow-up. So it depends on the employer whether they invite us back out again. And I can tell you that's a challenge as far as knowing whether or not the recommendations are accepted. Yes? Thank you. So the comment is an excellent one, and one that we have a philosophical debate on a daily basis in our office of whether or not, why actually do monitoring? And I think a lot of OSHA standards have this sort of inherent problem. If I go and sample for a painter, I can without a doubt know that their organic solvent exposure is going to be within the limits, but I want them to be in respiratory protection. So we're kind of stuck between this requirement to do monitoring that is written in the standard based off of the substance-specific standards, and then this catch-22 that we catch them on a day, which is why we've been using sort of statistics and categorizing their exposure to kind of couple our ability to communicate that to them. And that risk communication is so important because we have our hands tied behind our back from that perspective.
Can I do a follow-up to Tom's question? Did 60% probability have any influence on them, or did they say our samples are under, go away?
The question is, does that make an impact? And it does with some companies, but with others, and there are bad players out there, it does. It honestly doesn't make a difference what you say. But I think as many tools and as much written documentation that we can provide to them, they are being inspected by OSHA. So if we have all of this information documented and in print, it provides OSHA with the support that when they do the inspection, that we've created this kind of paper trail for them of what's already experienced. Yes. The question is whether or not they're really working from sun up to sundown, and the lead exposure limit you can adjust based off of the 8-hour workday. You can change it varying on how. For a matter of statistics, we based it off of the primary permissible exposure limit and action level, but typically they work what they're asked to work on a daily basis. As temporary employees and the ability to gain as much income as possible, I have gone out to companies where they do say they work an 8-hour day, but in all actuality, it is 10, 12-hour days, depending on the demand. So it is a demand-driven field. So if there's a train that comes in, drops off several tons of metal, they'll work longer till that's complete. As far as the exposure and the take-home exposure, we take that very seriously, and I didn't report on this data, but we do we do wipe samples when we go out to these facilities, and we will oftentimes wipe sample the employees' cars so that we can provide them with evidence that they are taking home the exposure. So that is one way that we try to kind of combat that problem.
I don't want to rob the other folks. This was
such an excellent example of what David Michaels talked about all the different tools OSHA uses to create safer environments.